Hey, I want to share with you a couple things that are going on that just pumps me up. So today is the start of a new series. Last week, we had the best Sunday ever, which is weird for me. Yeah, that's something to be excited about. It's weird. That was the title of the Sunday. Okay, it's the title of the Sunday. It's not a declarative statement like, I said, last week, we had the best Sunday ever. We're like, last week was the best Sunday ever. And then I go, and this week, so-so. So, good luck. For this week. That's not where we're going. And I want to share that. This just pumps me up. I understand that coming to a church for the first time can be really, really hard. Like, that is a courageous act to come to church for the first time. Because, man, if you have a church background, you know sometimes church people are weird people. Can I get an amen on that? What? That's the most. We have never had that much of a response when I ask something. Church people can be weird people. Yeah, I'll raise my hand to that. There we go. And so that can be difficult. And if you don't have a church background at all, it's just awkward because you don't know what to expect. And so it is a courageous act to come to a church for the first time. And it's a courageous act to invite a friend to church. And one of the things that excited me last week on the best Sunday ever, I'll just share with you one number. We had people who came to BCN for the first time. We had 61 people who came to BCN for the first time. Isn't that awesome? Man, that pumps me up. And I hope many of you are back this week. And I tell you again, this is not the so-so Sunday that follows the best Sunday ever. We've got some exciting stuff coming up. But two cool things that are coming up in the life of our church. We have two times a year that we do group signups. And if you're unfamiliar with what a small group is usually a group of 10 to 12 people who meet together about every week. Some groups meet every other week within there. Just to gather together, to hang out, to share what's going on, to pray for each other, to talk about the content of the message, not the quality of the message. I always want to emphasize that over and over again. But just really to do life together and to make sure we're growing together and headed the right direction. And so this Sunday and next Sunday is one of the times that we open up. The other time is in February to join a group. And so if you have thought about that at all, signing up doesn't lock you in. Someone will get in contact with you and see what all's going on. But to either sign up online or you can stop at one of the iPads out in the lobby or just pull out your phone right now and sign up. You're more than welcome to do that. But so we have group signups going on right now, and I'll talk some about my group even within the message. And then this Wednesday, we do this three times a year. This Wednesday kind of kicks off our Wednesday night ministries that we're having a family meeting. And eventually we're going to retitle it because it really scares people every time we say we're going to have a family meeting. Did anyone like grow up with a family that had family meetings? And a family meeting meant like someone was in trouble. And so like, oh, we're having a family meeting as a church. Who didn't put their toys away? Who's hitting their sister? It was me. And so when we say family meeting, we describe it like this, that it's a chance for us as a church to conduct the business of the church. And for us, the business of the church is three things. It's to worship, it's to pray, and to celebrate. And so this Wednesday night at 6:30, we're going to gather together. If you say, hey, this is my church home, these are my people, or if you're saying, I want to figure out if these are my people, then Wednesday night at 6:30, we invite you. We're going to be right in here for our family meeting, and we have so much to celebrate that's going on and so many things that we're excited about. So I want to invite you to both of those to be a part of that. But today we are starting our series, Hero Makers. And so I want to jump right in. If you have your Bible, we are going to be in Deuteronomy chapter 34. Deuteronomy chapter 34. If you do not have your Bible with you, you can use the one that is the row that you're in. That is our gift to you. You can take that with you. Or as always, you can follow along online at bcnazarene.org/gatherings. And if you do follow along online, the group signups are right there. So since you're already there, you might as well. Deaf ears. Thank you. Deuteronomy chapter 34 is where I want to begin. And the title, for those of you who are note takers, the title of the message today is The Problem of the Past. Would you turn to your neighbor and very resolutely say, The Problem of the Past. And now would you turn to your other neighbor who you just intuitively revealed that you like a little less and tell them as well, The Problem of the Past. Less of you did that. Amen to weird people in the church. Tell your other neighbor, problem of the past. Here we go, Deuteronomy chapter 34. I just want to give you a heads up on this, okay? We've got some exciting stuff we're going to talk about within this message, some really important stuff, but I just need to give you a heads up. It's going to start a little low, okay? And those of you who are following along in your Bible, you already see that this section is titled The Death of Moses, and you're like, oh, what are we in for? And so we're going to start here, and we'll get up here by the end, okay? So just stay with me. But Deuteronomy 34, it says this, "Then Moses went up to Mount Nebo from the plains of Moab and climbed Pisgah Peak." That's confusing to me because I used to live near Pisgah Pike. "Climbed Pisgah Peak, which is across from Jericho. And the Lord showed him the whole land." Now, just want to give you a heads up. These are words that, unless if you've been to the Middle East, mean nothing to you, okay? But just picture it from this description. Like, the people who would have read this around Moses' time would have known all of these places, okay? And so what they're doing within this description is they're grounding the Bible in historical reality, okay? Over and over again, what you'll find throughout the pages of Scripture is it asks us to question whether it was real. And the way it does that is instead of giving really broad generalizations on stuff, it gives dates and locations and names. And so if you go further on, sorry, this is the mini sermon within the sermon case, but you know, we'll get back to the thing and say, like, if you go through the writings of Paul, what he'll do is he'll say, like, this happened and this happened and this happened. And if you don't believe me, ask Doug. Go, he doesn't actually say Doug because that wasn't it. But he's like, hey, go ask this person. And they'll be able to verify my account. And so that's what they're doing here. So he's going to show them all this land, show them the whole land from Gilead as far as Dan, all the land of Naphtali, the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, all the land of Judah extending to the Mediterranean Sea, the Negev, the Jordan Valley with Jericho, the city of palms as far as Zoar. So he shows them all this land. Then the Lord said to Moses, "This is the land I promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob," Moses' distant descendants. He says, God made a promise that they would inherit all this land because he made it on promise. It was called the promised land. "This is the land I promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob when I said, I will give it to your descendants. I have now allowed you to see it with your own eyes, but you will not enter the land." It's rough, right? Like, there's a part of that that just to me that feels like kind of cruel. I've now allowed you to see it with your own eyes, but you don't get it. The other day I made the mistake. I came home, BCLC had leftover cookies, and so they left some in the office, and so I took cookies home for each of my kids. They were in like packages wrapper, and so I got home and I was like, "Kids, I've got cookies," and they're immediately, because like there's like cookies, give us the cookies. They turn into terrorists. Anytime there's sweets around, they're like punching each other. "Give us the cookies." I was like, "Oh, yeah, after dinner. You can have the cookies after dinner." "No!" I was like, "Now! We must have the cookies now!" I was like, that's how I feel like God's doing it. Like, here's the land. You're not going to enter into it. It's like, oh, God. My goodness. "I've now allowed you to see it with your own eyes, but you will not enter the land." Then verse 5. "So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, just as the Lord had said. The Lord buried him in a valley near Beth Peor in Moab, but to this day no one knows the exact place." And then this is the part that's really rough. He's right on the edge of this land that he has pursued, this calling on his life to lead the Israelites out of slavery from Egypt and enter the promised land. And he gets right to the edge of the promised land and he doesn't enter it. And then it says this as a detail. Moses was 120 years old when he died, yet his eyesight was clear and he was as strong as ever. He's as strong as ever. This is going to make some of you nervous. You know, kind of when you have it, like sometimes we get words, someone like, "Oh, my parent passed away," or "My grandparent passed away." And you're like, "Oh, I'm so sorry." And then some people will try to make you feel better and they'll just give their age. Like, my grandparent passed away. Like, and then immediately they're like, "She was 107. And we all do the same thing, don't we? This is nervous to admit right here, but we're all like, "Oh, so it was good." Right? Good, you laughed. So you too, not just me. Okay, I was really stepping out on the ledge right there on that one to make sure where we were. Like, we do that. And so you kind of give the, like, "Oh, so it's okay." Oh, so it's not like she was ready, you were ready, everyone was ready. So it's a good thing. Not Moses. Now, I know he's old, but it says, yet his eyesight was clear and he was as strong as ever. The people of Israel mourned for Moses on the plains of Moab for 30 days until the customary period of mourning was over. And I read that and there's a piece of that that is just heartbreaking to me. To go, here is Moses, God's prophet, and we're going to see some of the description of Moses as God's prophet in just a minute, who has, like, he's got this amazing account of his life in which, because of Pharaoh's fear of the Israelites, he was supposed to be killed as a child. He was miraculously saved, raised in Pharaoh's household. In a moment in which he stood up for his own people, he had to flee Pharaoh's household, becomes the leader of the Israelites, encounters God in an unbelievable way, does miracles, signs, wonders, leads the Israelites out of slavery, parts the Red Sea for them to walk through on dry land, walks them through the desert for 40 years as God feeds them. God himself feeds them every day, and then gets right to the edge of the promised land and dies. And it's not because he wasn't strong enough, and it wasn't because he didn't have the vision to enter it. He died right there. And this is the description that is given at the end. If you go to verse 10 on Moses' life, it says, there's never been another prophet in Israel like Moses whom the Lord knew face to face. The Lord sent him to perform all the miraculous signs and wonders in the land of Egypt against Pharaoh and all his servants in his entire land. With mighty power, Moses performed terrifying acts in the sight of all Israel. And it gives this like incredible like eulogy of Moses' life. Never has there been a prophet in Israel like Moses. And yet all these incredible statements are somewhat haunted by what we found in verse 4 and the start of verse 5. He died, not entering the land, and yet his eyesight was clear, and he was as strong as ever. And we would look at this and we would go, for Moses, success would have been leading the people into the promised land. And so there's this piece of it that you go, man, Moses did these incredible things, and yet he kind of comes off as a failure, right? His eulogy reads like a tragedy. And you just kind of feel bad. You're just like, man, that's it? So close, but not quite there. And if we could like pull this out for a second and go, it's not just that he didn't enter the promised land. That's not the only reason why his life reads like a tragedy. Because even if he had accomplished what he set out to accomplish, there's a possible that his life would be viewed as a failure. Jesus talks about this idea. He tells this parable of the trappings of success. And this is how he tells the story. What has happened is he's had all these followers and his disciples see, like, all these people are coming, like, more and more people are coming. And so they're like, kind of like, oh, we're a big deal. Like, look at us. Like, I know they're following Jesus, but we followed him first. So they're kind of, in essence, following us because we're following him closer. And so they're like they're excited about who they are. And then Jesus tells this parable. We're going to put it on the screen. This is what it says in Luke chapter 12. It says, then he told them a story. A rich man had a fertile farm that produced fine crops. He said to himself, love this, what should I do? I don't have room for all my crops. Can I give a modern day parallel? Got a promotion, got a new job, got a better job. You go, what should I do? I've got more money than I used to have. I have success in life. I have accomplishment. You go, what should I do? I don't have room for all my crops. And so this is what he did, what most of us only have imagination to do. Then he said, I know, I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. Brilliant. So creative. What do I want in my next house? Better than my current house. What do I want in my next car? Bigger and better than my current car. What do I want in my next relationships? Better than my current friends. That's what I'm looking for. You understand right now in this moment, I'm giving this as a metaphor, not speaking confessional to me personally. Okay, we're all on the same page. It's like, well, I guess we're no longer friends, Kevin. Thank you very much. We had that. For most of us, that is what our imagination is. And it usually comes out that success in life is one of two things, and we'll run on different paths based upon what our interests are. Success in life is possession accumulation or experience enjoyment. And we view it as that if I can get enough stuff, if I can get the right stuff, then my life will be viewed as a success. Or if I can do cool things and the things that I've always wanted to do and tell stories of my travels, then my life will be a success. And that's what he says. It's not a new thing. What am I going to do with all I have? I'll tear down my barns and I'll build bigger ones. But this is what takes place. Then I'll have room enough to store all my wheat and other goods. And I'll sit back and say to myself, my friend, side note, this is kind of like the story within the story. You should never refer to yourself as my friend. Like there's a greater meaning within this parable, but if you call yourself my friend, that's a whole other problem that we need to address at some point in time. Then I'll say to myself, my friend, you have enough stored away for years to come. Now take it easy, eat, drink, and be merry. But this is the problem. But God said to him, you fool. You will die this very night. Then who will get everything you worked for? Yes, a person is a fool to store up earthly wealth, but not have a rich relationship with God. And the meaning within the story is not simply significantly spiritual in the moment. It's not simply about possession accumulation or experience enjoyment. The meaning of the parable is deeper than this. It's about the fact that your life is not meant to be about yourself. That even if Moses enters the promised land, his life could be viewed as a failure if he views it as his own success. I love self-help books. I love to read self-help books. By definition, they don't work, because if self-help books actually worked, there would only ever need to be one, and that would solve all of our problems. So the fact that there are more and more self-help books means that they don't actually work, but I still love to read them, and all of them are failures. I apologize if you're an author of a self-help book, like one of the most popular ones, Your Best Life Now. This is the trapping within that. We talk about your best life now. Your life isn't about you. Like your best life isn't about you. So if you pursue your best life now, your life is not going to be a success, because your life was never meant to be about you. And so this is what I want to do in this series. I want to pull back a couple steps, and I want to talk about this idea of legacy. I want to talk about the concept about the legacy that we live, about the legacy that we leave, and about how we're remembered, about what our life did and how it was enabled to be passed off to those around us. And I know for some of us, we're all at different stages of life in this room, and there'd be the trapping, especially the younger that you get, you'd be like, legacy, that's what older people think about. That's what people think about when they can no longer do stuff. Like they think about legacy. Like I can still do stuff. When I can no longer do, I'll worry about my legacy. But I've never met a single person who goes, you know what, I really am upset that I started thinking about my legacy too early in life. I really wish I would have lived my life more haphazardly. That's what I think would have helped me. And so I'll talk about that idea of legacy. And I heard this quote just this past week on legacy. It was beautiful. It says, legacy is the story about you that is yet to be written, but of which you hold the pen. Isn't that good? Like I said that, and I just like got goosebumps at the end. Like the story about you that is yet to be written, but of which you hold the pen. I was like, that's awesome. I hold the pen. I'm typing it on my phone because I take notes that way. But yeah, I hold the metaphorical pen within my life. Story about you that is yet to be written, but of which you hold the pen. I want to talk about leaving a legacy that matters. And here's the thing. And those of you who are following along closely within Scripture, you already realize this. Is that if you take one verse out of the eulogy of Moses' life, his life is viewed as a failure. We skipped a verse. And if you take that one thing out, his eulogy reads as a tragedy. But if you put this one thing back in, it makes all the difference in the world of a life that matters, of a life that is significant, and a legacy that continues on in someone's life for someone who's just quickly forgotten. And whether they actually get the bigger barns, whether they enter the promised land or not, makes the difference as to whether their life is considered a failure or not. I want to show you what it looks like. This is Deuteronomy chapter 34. The verse that we skipped is verse 9. I'm going to start reading further back, and then we're going to put verse 9 on the screen so we can get the full flow of it. It says, so Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, just as the Lord had said. The Lord buried him in a valley near Beth Peor into Moab, but to this day, no one knows the exact place. Moses was 120 years old when he died, yet his eyesight was clear and he was as strong as ever. The people of Israel mourned for Moses on the plains of Moab for 30 days until the customary period of mourning was over. And then it says this, now Joshua, son of Nun, that's not like son of nobody, his dad's actually name was Nun. You thought you had an inconvenient name. I thought I had an inconvenient name at times. Son of Nun. He'll amount to some. Now Joshua, son of Nun, was full of the spirit of wisdom. I want you to do this. Turn to your neighbor very loud. Pronounce it. Say, was. This is important. It says, Joshua was full of the spirit of wisdom. Now, this is looking back on Joshua's life. If it was present day, okay, if this was said in the present, it would say is. It would say Joshua is full of the spirit of wisdom. Because we're looking back, we say Joshua was full of the spirit of wisdom. This is important. It's defining that Joshua is different. That if something hadn't happened, Joshua would not be full of the spirit of wisdom, but he is full of the spirit of wisdom. And here is the reason why. The next word is incredibly important. For Moses had laid his hands on him. Please turn to your neighbor and say again with as much enthusiasm as the first time, say for. This is a statement of connection. It would be the same as saying, because Joshua was full of the spirit of wisdom, Joshua is different because Moses had laid his hands on him. And I don't think you're not smart, okay, that you can't make the connection, but I think often we gloss over this. The obvious thing that it's stating is if Moses had not laid his hands on him, he would not be full of the spirit of wisdom. That makes sense, right? Like we can see that. That's really obvious within there. I point that out because it is so easy for us at times to view our actions as inconsequential, to view the things we do as insignificant. And what this passage is saying is already so significant. It's saying that Joshua's life is different, that the spirit of God was in him because Moses did this one thing. He laid his hands on him. And if he hadn't laid his hands on him, then the full spirit of wisdom would not be with Joshua. We're gonna take an opportunity this Wednesday night at our family meeting. We're gonna do something that for some of you may feel a little weird. But what we're gonna do is we're gonna have Amy Frazier, our BCLC director. She's not gonna be wearing an Elastigirl costume this Wednesday. Unless if you really want. I mean, I guess you can. I'm not gonna tell you no. And Robbie Brown, our manager at the coffee shop at the Bridge Cafe on Wright State campus. And we're gonna have all the students and all the teachers from our congregation at a certain point in time in the family meeting. We're gonna invite them to come down because coming back to school is a significant marker in anyone's life. And we believe that there are spiritual battles that take place in those classrooms and in those hallways. And we believe there's an incredible witness that can be given. And so what we're going to do as a church is we're going to invite all the students and the teachers to come down and part of BCLC, and we're just going to say, hey, we're just going to pray for you. And we're going to lay our hands on them because I believe oftentimes God's spirit is transmitted through physical touch, and we're going to pray for them that God would be with them and his spirit would guide them in the same way that because Moses laid his hands on Joshua, that the spirit of wisdom was in him. As we say, Joshua is different. That's the was. For, because Moses laid his hands on him. And then here's the last word that I want you to be aware of. So, turn to your neighbor, say so. So the people of Israel obeyed him, doing just as the Lord had commanded Moses. And so he's saying, life is different. Now put these together. This is so important, okay? So important. Life is different for the people of Israel because Moses did this one thing of taking aside Joshua and developing him and encouraging him and laying his hands on him and praying him. And Joshua was different. Joshua was different because Moses was there. And because Moses was there, his life was different and everyone's life was different because of this. And so we talk about this idea of leaving a legacy, and we have this like the beautiful phrase, legacy is the story about you that is yet to be written, but of which you hold the pen. And there's a problem with that. Like, it's so poetic. And we assume that if something's like really poetic, and sometimes if it rhymes, that it has to be true, right? If it rhymes, it's gotta be true. Always true. Any pastor who says something that rhymes, or if they like invert the words on themselves, like, I don't believe it, but he inverted the words. And so it's gotta be good. Like, I mean, yeah, it's gotta be true. As we're talking about that, but of which you hold the pen, there's a problem with this. the account that's written in Deuteronomy 34 about Moses, he's dead. We acknowledge that? He's dead. Like, Moses does this incredible thing. Like, Moses wrote the first five books of the Bible. Even the part in the Bible where it says Moses was extremely humble. Moses was actually the most humble man in the entire earth. I remember the first time I read that, I was like, who's writing this? Moses was the most humble man in the entire world. It's Moses. Like, that's a tricky move right there, is it not? The most humble man in the entire world. You wrote this. I think that disqualifies you. So Moses wrote this. Moses wrote Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, but he didn't write Deuteronomy 34 because he's dead. And so we have this idea. There's two theories as to who wrote Deuteronomy 34, who wrote the eulogy on Moses' life. The first theory, which is the less believed theory, is that it was a guy by the name of Ezra who was a scribe at the time. The second theory, which is the more predominantly held view, is that it was Joshua. And that Joshua, when he looks back on Moses' life and he gives this incredible account, the one thing that he remembers is he remembers, my life was different. My future was different because Moses was there for me. My life was better because Moses was here in this moment and he set me up for success. If he hadn't been there, I know God wouldn't have been with me and the people wouldn't have responded the way that they did. And so because he did that, our future was better because of his actions in this moment. And so we talk about what it looks like for success to take place. And the reality is this, is that for Moses, his life would be written as a tragedy if he did not have a successor. His life would be written as a failure if succession didn't take place. And the same is true of you. That for you in your life, whatever your calling is, whatever your goal is, whatever your direction is, this is what I want you to see in this first week of the series, that there is no success without succession. There is no success in your life if succession doesn't take place. If your life is about your best life now, I need to get off that title, okay? Because otherwise I'm gonna get more emails. Don't send me emails, okay? If your life is about your best life now, it's a failure because your life isn't meant to be about you. I need something here. Like, I mean, I can keep going throughout the whole time. Like, if we're just, I disagree, Kevin. No, thank you. Okay, I need a little more within there. It's not. And I think the thing that has become so hard and so difficult within this, and this is the phrase that's been going through my head, is I think we've gotten really good at catching God's blessings, but we've gotten really bad at passing them on. And so, like, the really spiritual thing that we'll do is, like, we'll have a moment, like, kind of like, oh, yeah, God has just blessed us. He is just so good. Bigger barns. I'm going to build bigger ones. That's what I'm looking for. Is that, no. You're not just supposed to catch it and hold on to it. You're meant to pass it on. And I get it. No one wants to pass the ball, right? No one wants to, like, not a single one of us ever when we were growing up went out to our driveway, practice basketball, counted it down in our head. Championship game, down one, 5 seconds left. You've got the ball. Dribble, dribble, 4 seconds left. Makes a fake, 3 seconds left. Drives in, 2 seconds left. Passes it to the bush. Imaginary bush takes the winning shot. Like, right? No one did that. No one was like, yeah, my best friend just hit the winning shot. I'm so excited. Like, right? We all took the shot, didn't we? We all imagined that, like, we often missed the shot. That's why we didn't actually live it out in real life. Personal confession within there. There we go. But, like, we all had those imaginations. I struggle with this with my kids. My kids never want to pass. Like, it doesn't matter what we're doing. If we're playing soccer in the backyard, no one ever passes. This past year, I was coaching my kids' BC Naz Kids basketball team, the basketball ministry we do on a Saturday morning. I'm coaching that. Part of BC Naz Kids basketball is they want every kid to get a shot. Every kid gets to take a shot. And so my daughter, Emily, she had already taken 4 shots in this game. And I'm like, oh, this is bad. Like, 4 shots. Other kids hadn't taken a shot. Not only am I the coach, I'm the pastor. Like, I need to get this under control. She'd taken 4 shots. And so she gives this thing, someone lost the ball, she stole the ball, you're not supposed to steal, not just because of BC Naz Kids Basketball, but commandments as well. She stole the ball, and she dribbles it down, and she gets right in front of the hoop. So like she dribbles it the whole way down the court, gets right in front of the hoop, stops. And I scream out, "Emmy, pass!" And this is what she does, complete, "Emmy, pass!" She looks at me, she looks at the hoop, she looks back at me, and then took the shot. She made it, just to be clear, she made it. Stretch her stuff out. I wanna show you this, I even with my son, my only son, I can't get him to pass. And so like we play this game in our house, he's got this like little Fisher Price basketball hoop, and like Bethany will tell him like, Parker, pass the ball. He passes it to her every time. Loves his mom. Blah. Passes it to her every time. I can't get him to pass to me. Like I say, we actually took a video to show you how frustrating this is when your own flesh and blood won't even pass you the ball. I wanna show you, you can enjoy my anxiety and frustration on this.
Pass.
He's not good at standing.
Here you go, pass, pass. Here you go, I pass.
I even show him.
Right, pass. Here you go, right, pass. Pass back, Parker, pass it.
Again with the standing.
Hop up, right, pass.
I didn't ask for a hug. I asked for a pass. That's exactly right. And we don't like that. And so we like catching what God has given us. And I think this is what is buried within there. Like we joke about it with the kids, but every single one of us wants to view our lives as the high point, right? We want to view ourselves as the hero. We want to view what we're doing in our life as the most significant. We only have our own perspective. So we automatically assume we're the protagonist and the hero of every story, do we not? I had this, many of you are aware of this, before I was here at BCN, I had the opportunity to be a part of a group of friends that planted a church. I got to be the pastor of that group. And we grew incredibly over 6-7 years, part of being the pastor. And then God called us here to be a part of this community of faith in Beaver Creek. And I had this, eventually working through a process called a new guy as their senior pastor. And after about a year, their attendance was higher than it was when I was there. And I had all these people come up to me and ask me, they're like, "Oh, they're running more than they were when you were there. Are you okay with that? Are you okay with that?" And here's the thing within there, is my initial response, yes! What do you think I wanted it to be? Like Kevin left and the whole thing fell apart, right? But is there not a small piece of us that likes that? Is there not a small piece of us, like when I come home and Bethany's there with all the kids, like, "Thank goodness you're back, they've been crazy." That's right. I make these kids get in line. You're laughing too much, just to be clear. You're like, "No, that's not what's happening, Kevin, you get it." Is it like, but there's like that piece of us that wants to view all of our own lives as the high point within there. And so we have this account that's the end of Moses' life, that Moses is the edge of the promised land and dies. And then the next book of the Bible, the story continues and talks about how the people entered the promised land. Do you know what the next book of the Bible is titled? It's titled Joshua. And all of a sudden, Joshua is the hero of the story. And Joshua is the man who leads the people into what God has promised. Not Moses. Not Moses, who had to walk through the people for 40 years in the desert while they were complaining. He didn't get to do it. Joshua. Joshua's the one. And there's that thing in us that goes, "Man, I want to be the hero. Oh, I want the account of greatness to be told about me." But this is what I want you to see that is so important. In Hebrews chapter 11, we're not going to look at it. It gives a listing of people. It's called the Hall of Faith. And it lists all these people who are the spiritual heroes. And Moses is listed. And the reason why Moses is listed as a hero in our faith is not simply because of what he did, but who he passed on his faith to. That Moses is listed as a hero because he makes Joshua a hero. The thing that made Moses so significant in his life and in his walk is that he was a hero maker for Joshua. You cannot simultaneously attempt to hoard all the credit and make yourself the hero of the story and also develop someone else to be the hero as well. And Moses doesn't do this. He doesn't do this because he couldn't hang with it anymore. We saw this in verse 7. It says this, that his eyesight was as clear. His eyesight was still clear and he was as strong as ever. Moses did not get to this spot in his life. He's going, man, I just can't cut it anymore. I need someone else to take over this. Otherwise, it's all going to fall apart. He still had it. And it wasn't simply because that if he crossed in, then he would have been a success. We talked about that with the bigger barns. Success is not more and more. But what we see is that Moses deliberately throughout his life spent time investing in Joshua. We get this clue in the book of Numbers. It says this, Joshua, son of Nun, who had been Moses' assistant since his youth. This is not a last-ditch effort by Moses to create some meaning in his life. Since his youth, he had done this. And so this is what we need to do. This is my encouragement for us today, is I think we need to change the finish line in our faith. Turn to your neighbor, tell him, change the finish line. And this is what has happened, is for so long we have viewed faith as an individual sport, as an individual competition. And we'll talk about things in the language of my walk, my faith, my journey, my hope, my call. And we use singular language over and over again within it, is because somewhere along the way we have assumed with faith that it's just about us and where we're going and where we individually are headed. And we need to switch that. And we need to all of a sudden begin to understand, no, this is a communal event. This is a team sport. This is something that we do together. And it's greater than just you, your immediate friends, and your family. It's more significant than that, that if you're not helping others along the way, then you're not doing what God has called you to do. We have this account. Jesus gives us this great commission, is what we refer to it. And he says, go and make disciples of all nations. I'm not sure, you could make an argument, I'm not sure if you can be a disciple by yourself. I'm not sure. You say this, I would probably disagree with you. You go, I'm a disciple, I'm never a part of the church, I don't have any friends, I'm not doing any ministry, but I'm a disciple. You may be able to argue with that, I would argue against. You may be able to be a disciple by yourself. You cannot make disciples if you're the only one in the room. That's obvious, right? And so if you're going to live out the mission that God has for you, to do it with others becomes absolutely essential. We have this account. How many of you love the Olympics? I don't mean like I watched it. Like you love the Olympics. Like all of a sudden you become an expert on curling. All of a sudden, like the slalom, it doesn't matter what it is. They like combine all these different things. Like they ski and then they shoot stuff. I don't know what that's about, but all of a sudden I figured it out and I'm a huge fan of it. I love the Olympics. And one of the stories in the Olympics that I found fascinating is the story of the U.S. women's 4x100-meter relay team. And what has happened over a series of Olympics, if we could date back some, is that the U.S. women over and over again had some of the fastest runners in the world. They were expected to get silver at worst. They were that good. In 2000, they fielded an incredible team of 4 sprinters. And what happens is on the third time in which they've got to pass the baton from one sprinter to the other, when it's the individual race, they just start, they go, they cross the finish line, and wherever they land is where they go. When they do the relay, they have to pass the baton to the next person. They didn't practice it. And so in the 2000 Olympics, when it gets to the spot of passing the baton, it was sloppy, it was messy, and they ended up finishing third. In the next Olympics, in the 2004 Olympics, what happened is as they're coming down the home stretch from the third runner to the fourth runner, Marion Jones was the third runner, and she had spent the whole day competing before in the long jump, and so she was a little tired. And the goal is she's coming in, and when she yells go, the next runner is supposed to start running, and so that they can pass the baton when both of them are at full speed, but they have a narrow space of distance in which they're able to do that. And so Marion Jones yells go, and she ran out of energy before she could get to the next runner on her team, and they passed the baton outside the exchange zone and were disqualified. There's a lot there. She ran out of energy before she could pass the baton, and they were disqualified. The next year, again, they're expected to win gold this time, 2008, expected to win gold, and they didn't practice the pass. And when it came time for the baton to be passed in the finals, they dropped it and finished dead last. If your mind, if your focus has been encapsulated, has been obsessed with personal pronouns, with first-person personal pronouns, when it comes to your faith, you have missed what the actual finish line is. You were meant to do this with others. This is why for us as a church, we talk about groups so much. Because to make disciples, you have to be with other people. It's essential to actually be with other people to make disciples. And I've talked about, this is interesting. I've had two or three people come up to me in the last couple months when I've talked about my group, and they said, well, your group needs to split up. Which is like, I view my group as like my family. And so that's like someone coming out like, you and your wife need to get divorced. I feel uncomfortable with you. But then so like, your group needs to split up. I was like, why does our group need, why are you so concerned about my group? But first, why does my group need to split up? And the comment was, they said, well, you have a group full of leaders. You could all lead different groups. And like I get part of that. And there's some stuff we know is coming on the horizon for our group that we've committed to being together through. But I go through our group and I go, JC and Sheila Sloan, they're a part of our group. They're on staff. They were my first friend. They were my only friends that I had when we moved here. So they're the only people I knew to ask. And Bruce and Becky Brown, they were JC and Sheila's friends. And so we asked them. Becky spoke on stage as part of our forgiveness series in April. Have VJ and Melanie Williams. VJ's an unpaid staff member here who does all our social media and marketing and everything else, and you've seen him on stage significantly. You've heard, if you've been here for a while, I've told the story of Ty and Abby Walls. And Ty's on our Next Gen team now and is significantly involved in our worship ministry. Seth and Chelsea Cadle. Seth plays guitar and they lead a young adult ministry called The Link. Mike and Anita Mummert. Mike is running screens this morning and is on point, is he not? You weren't prepared for that, I understand. I kind of jumped on that. And people are like, you have a group full of leaders, and this is what I want to say. We weren't when we started. We weren't when we started. Some of us were disconnected. Mike and Anita had been to church, I think, one time. Ty and Abby, I've told you the story of Ty. Ty told me, hey, I've done the church and ministry thing for, I'm done. You're lucky to see me twice a month. You're probably lucky to see me once a month. We weren't when we started, but we committed to being together and to continuously encourage and strengthen each other. And so because of that, we've grown into that together. And if your focus of your faith is only limited to the scope of your own life, and you have made yourself the hero, you are not living the life God has called you to live, because you were meant to be a hero maker. And so I want to show you this. This needs to become, for us, the burning desire of our lives. It needs to become the call of our lives and the things that we're living into. And this is Psalm 71:18. It says this. Even when I am old and gray, do not forsake me, my God. Not till I accomplish what I meant to accomplish. Not till I can finish this project that I've been working on. Not till I get the promotion. Not till I can tear down these barns and build bigger ones. That's not what he says. He says, even when I am old and gray, do not forsake me, O Lord. Let me do this one thing till I declare your power to the next generation, your mighty acts to all who come. Isn't that amazing? And so I ask you today, who is your was, for, so? Who is your person whose life is going to be different because you are invested in, so their future is better because of your presence? Who is the person that you're going to say, I'm going to go out of my way, not out of my own convenience, not out of my preference, but to make their life better? And what is at stake is not developing skills. What is at stake is not talent acquisition. What is at stake within this is not simply, oh, their life is a little better because I'm there. This is deeper than mentoring. This is more significant than just spending some time with someone else. Our faith is at stake. The future of our faith hinges on people who are willing to go out of their way to make sure that other people know not just what they know, but who God is. He says within this, look at this so clearly. Could we put it back up here? I apologize, I went too far. He says, till I declare your power. Is that what is burning within your heart? God, I've got all these things I need to do, but until I declare your might to all those to come, let me continue. Give me enough strength so I can let them know of how great you are. So I can let them know about what you've done so that their faith will be stronger because I had a presence here. I'm gonna invite you right now. Would you please, would you stand together in this moment? I ask you today, is that you? Hey, do you find yourself in a spot where you go, man, my life has been too wrapped in up in me? When I look about the plans for my life, they are my plans, they are my agenda, they are my goals, and they're my purpose, and they be felt empty over time. And what I need is more of my Heavenly Father in there. And in order to get more of my Heavenly Father in there, I need to be focused on those around you. I wanna invite you right now, if that's you, a moment of confession, would you raise your hand? And say, man, I need to stretch out. I need to lean in someone else. I need to help someone else. I don't want to be the hero. I want to be a hero maker. I want someone else to be able to say, my life is better because they were with me. I want to invite you right now, if that's you and your hand is raised, if someone near your hand is raising, you may have to put your hand on each other's shoulders. Would you place a hand on their shoulder? Right now in this moment, if that's around you, make sure. If anyone's hand is raised around you, place your hand on their shoulder and we're gonna pray together right now in this moment. Living God of the heavens and the earth, may our minds, our hearts, and souls become encapsulated with who you are. May we become obsessed with the greatness of your name. May we make you famous in everything that we do. May our lives not be focused on who we are and what we have to do. May we no longer be the hero of the story, but we may continuously turn to others, show them your majesty, show them your glory, show them your wonder, and make our every desire and heart to be declare your acts, your might, and your power to all those to come. And with this, all God's people said,